A conversation about homelessness in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. What role do cities play in helping people experiencing homelessness? The city of Miami has a few million dollars in federal money to use for solutions. What are the plans to spend it on? Also, it's looking likely that one of Miami's most historic resorts will soon be torn down. We'll take a look at the Deauville Beach Resort and the role that it played in South Florida history. The Beatles even played there. But first, monoclonal treatments are popular in Florida. What do we know? And where can COVID patients get them? All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. COVID-19 infections are down in Florida after the holidays and Omicron. Even the number of ICU beds being used are down. But we're not out of the woods, and there are still a lot of questions about best treatments, especially if you get the Omicron variant. Experts say the best possible way to protect oneself is still through vaccination. But if you get COVID, can monoclonal treatments help? More centers are popping up across South Florida. Joining us now to discuss, healthcare reporter for WLRN, Veronica Zaragovia, and Palm Beach County reporter for WLRN, Wilkin Brutus. I appreciate both of you joining me today. Veronica, I want to start with you. Let's again clarify, what is monoclonal therapy treatment exactly?
Right. Well, remember that an antibody is a protein produced by your immune system to respond to an infection. So what a monoclonal antibody is, it's a molecule that's made in a lab, and it mimics how your body's immune system would respond against, in this case, the SARS-CoV-2 infection. That's the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. It's also been used to treat cancer, to treat Ebola. So these aren't new. The spike protein on the coronavirus the monoclonal antibodies are supposed to bind to that spike protein and block it from invading a human cell. And so that's the idea.
Now, I know that the governor's been pushing this, but has this been cleared by medical experts?
The Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, issued an emergency use authorization. So that doesn't mean that they've been, you know, like officially approved for long-term use. This is an EUA because of the pandemic.
And who meets the requirement to get this treatment? Can anybody do it?
So anybody 12 and older who is positive with the coronavirus, with COVID-19, it's intended for people who are 65 and older, who have chronic medical conditions, who have suppressed immune systems, or who take medications that suppress their immune system. So it's not meant for someone who is considered, you know, fully healthy. It's meant for other groups of people who have a harder time, who the vaccines, for instance, don't produce the same level of antibodies as in a healthier person.
All right. Let's talk about sites where you could find these places. I'm going to go to Palm Beach County. Wilkin, are there a lot? Where do you find them? Where are they?
Yeah, there's a monoclonal treatment site at Westgate Park in West Palm Beach. There's one at Publix number 371 at 2895 North Military Trail. And recently, the Florida Department of Health opened a new site to distribute the monoclonal treatment at the West Boynton Recreation Center in Lake Worth. And that's been open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
And you went to the one in Boynton, right?
Yeah, on a day that it opened, the West Boynton Recreation Center in Lake Worth is quite a spacious spot. It's a gymnasium, and people can expect to be sort of greeted by medical professionals who will handle their paperwork once they walk in.
Just curious, when you were there, though, did you see a lot of people?
It was okay. I'd say probably around 70 people when I got there. Actually a little bit less than that. So around 25 that specific day, they had treated up to like 71 folks.
I see. And
patients were seated several feet apart from each other until the lead nurse called their name. The demographics there when I reported, was much older as well. Spoke to lead nurse Tony Rollet, and she said they've received just over 1,100 doses of Regeneron, a limited supply of it, and she hopes to receive more later this month. And she also said that they've had hundreds of patients walk through their doors so far.
Yeah, and speaking of, again, Tony Rollet is the name of the lead nurse. She also, you know, you talked to her too a little bit more about understanding, you know, what the situation is right now. Let's take a listen.
The virus seems to penetrate our cells, and then it causes damage. The sooner you can get here, you'll have relief of symptoms and stop any further problems if you have any underlying conditions.
Did she tell you anything else about, like, best time to seek out the treatment?
Yeah, she essentially said, look, if you feel symptoms within the first 10 days, it's probably best for you to seek treatment if you have an underlying condition. And so she made those specific stipulations. And folks who are older, like I said, the overall demographics from what I've seen during my reporting was at, I want to say, 65 and up. And so, yeah, so underlying conditions, age is a huge factor there, and symptoms within the first 10 days or so.
You know, Veronica, I mentioned it just a second ago, the governor's a big fan of this. He's been pushing it a lot. Do we know why?
Well, we can, you know, speculate. There's a large donor to his one of his big donors holds Regeneron stock. We also know he's someone who refuses to say if he has received a booster shot, and it seems that a segment of his voter bloc is against vaccines. So this is like there's more attention on these monoclonal antibody treatments than on getting vaccinated from, you know, the messaging from the state government. I should clarify that these are absolutely not meant to replace vaccinations. They are a treatment, but they don't replace vaccines. And I mean, every email we get from the Department of Health or from his office has some attack on the federal government. So it might be a way to seem like Florida is doing something else.
And yeah, he criticized the president for not getting enough of the treatments to Florida. But how did President Joe Biden respond?
Well, the Biden administration did cut back on these drugs that were sent to a number of southern states, including Florida, at some point, saying that they needed to make it fit more fair, and other states should also receive their share. And then it became a way, you know, a public knowledge that some of these treatments are almost ineffective against Omicron, then the federal government has been trying to motivate states to provide other treatment because the majority of the variant, of the cases, are the Omicron variant. But the federal government is sending Regeneron and Eli Lilly, but they're pushing for. It seems like they're going to try to even reduce that so that states don't continue to offer it as much.
And you just mentioned the two treatments, Regeneron and Eli Lilly. What's their effectiveness though against Omicron?
Right. So it seems that the particular mutation of the spike protein of the Omicron, it seems like these treatments are almost completely unable to neutralize that spike protein. There is a minor form of the Omicron variant that is completely resistant to these antibodies produced by Regeneron or Eli Lilly. But that being said, in the studies that I've read or from what I've heard from doctors, it's not like, oh, this is garbage and throw it out. It's just like they're calling on more studies to be made. And but I wish I could spend time with people who go get the treatment. It's just like the risk of being near people who are positive with COVID, but it would be helpful to know what they're saying.
But what are the doctors saying about, is it worth it? Is it, you know?
Yeah, so doctors are saying, you know, the vast majority of people who get COVID-19, including myself, we don't know which one we got, which variant we had. I really don't. I can only guess that maybe I got the Omicron because it is almost 100% of the cases, of the proportion of cases, but we don't know. So a doctor whose mission, you know, even saving one life is a doctor's mission, they would never, you know, someone who is 65 and older, who is at very high risk of developing severe illness from COVID-19, they cannot say, sit at home and cross your arms. Like, if this treatment is available and maybe you're in that 0.3% of cases that is Delta still, then why not? Like, just try it.
And you talked to a doctor about the ethics of making false promises. Is that what this is? If, you know, we're not sure. And what did he say to you?
I spoke to Dr. Joshua Lenches. He's the chief medical officer at Broward Health, and he has helped us throughout this whole pandemic in making sense of the virus and the disease and the medication. And he said that, you know, he would recommend for someone who is susceptible to extreme illness to go get the treatment. It's either an IV infusion or it's a shot. And he didn't think it's totally worthless. I mean, he had also, the CDC keeps a table with the percentage of the variants in each state. And through December 25th, Florida had 25% Delta. Now it seems like it's far less, but you know, for anybody who does have Delta or anybody who maybe it is effective, even if you have Omicron, they would say it's worth trying.
Mm. All right. So when you go to any of these sites, obviously there's a process. Wilkin, you got to see that whole process. What do people need to know when you show up? You got to be ready.
Oh, absolutely. The lead nurse, Tony Rollet, said people who are feeling symptoms and are seeking treatments should bring a mask because they'll be waiting for their appointment around other patients. People should definitely bring their government-issued IDs and an insurance card. They won't be billed directly.
Is there any chance anybody gets turned away?
She did not insinuate that folks would get turned away. Again, most of the people who are going to these treatment centers are actually really feeling sick. The demographics skew much older, and folks tend to have underlying conditions. And so Tony Rollet isn't really saying that she has had any opportunity to turn folks away. Folks who have arrived are really feeling hurt at this moment.
Have you heard of like anybody who doesn't have a government ID?
I have not heard any of that, no.
Okay. And how long does this treatment last? Because I heard it's not quick.
Oh, it lasts, I want to say, an hour and a half. You do need an hour to wait after you get your shots to make sure that you aren't feeling any adverse effects from the shots itself. And so, yeah, she does suggest that you hang on for an hour. So in totality, an hour and a half.
All right. So it's going to be a little bit of time. And you had mentioned it, too, with insurance. Veronica, do I have to have insurance?
Well, what I got from the Department of Health is that it's free to all Florida residents. And that's just kind of up to interpretation. I don't know if you need to prove you live here. They might ask for your insurance because they bill the insurance company for that. But that does, you shouldn't think that you're going to get billed if you know you qualify. And and I did want to mention something briefly, that these last, like, the protection maybe about 5 months is what it's thought to do. And so you should wait 90 days after an infusion or after you're receiving the drug therapy to get either your first vaccine if you didn't get vaccinated, your second vaccine, or your booster shot. And and you can make an appointment at patientportalfl.com if you decide that you want to take that chance and go try it. Some people do say they've gotten a rash or nausea or diarrhea. There are some side effects. So just when you go, that we want to make sure people know there's no 100% promise of healing.
And we will share that link on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to thank WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia, and WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus. Veronica, Wilkin, thank you for the insight. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Louis.
Thank you.
And again, if you want to know more about the monoclonal treatments, you still have questions, go to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Miami's putting more money towards solving homelessness while at the same time putting more restrictions on people who live on the streets. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The city of Miami is infusing more money into efforts to try and reduce homelessness. $3.1 million in federal funding, to be exact. The goal is to reduce homelessness in Miami down to quote-unquote functional zero. But the decision comes after a string of recent restrictions from the city, including banning encampments, restricting where and how aid groups can feed people, and even creating a program where city residents can, quote, adopt people experiencing homelessness. Joining me now is the president and CEO of Chapman Partnership, Samaria Hudson. Samaria, welcome to the program.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I really do appreciate it. You know, Samaria, I wanted to ask you what you're seeing right now, because thinking about this segment as I was coming into work and I noticed these last few weeks, I'm seeing more homeless encampments around different parts of downtown Miami, but especially like when I come across the bridge on First Avenue or First Street, then the Second Avenue around there, I've seen just, it started with one tent, then two, now a couple dozen. I'm seeing more. But what are you seeing? What's happening?
Well, let's talk about that. I want to first let your audience know who we are. I think it's first to start there. Chapman Partnership has been around in the community for 26 years. And we are the public-private partner of the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust. And this topic of ending homelessness and fighting homelessness in our community has been a goal and an effort of so many, including the Trust, Chapman Partnership, Camilla's House, Lotus House, Salvation Army, Miami Rescue, and so many others. And so it's always been our fight to end homelessness. Now, certainly, you know, our goal is to get everyone as possible into shelter to get the support that they need. So certainly what you're seeing is what we call the chronically homeless. And those individuals are the toughest. They're the toughest to move inside of shelter. But certainly once they are in shelter, that's really where a lot of the work really begins. Everything from supporting those individuals that are homeless to finding housing, jobs, support, and certainly at some point, I'm quite sure we're going to talk about the amazing effort and support by Miami City Mayor Suarez on some of the work that he's doing to really help attack this effort, along with all the individuals that I spoke about.
Well, let's talk about the money then that the city is putting towards this, as I mentioned, and it's broken up into a couple of different areas here. But let's talk about, again, the Chapman Partnership's getting 200,000 of these funds that I mentioned, the three million plus for workforce development training. Okay, so it, specifically, what does that do? How does that help, especially the folks that I just mentioned?
Absolutely. So certainly the you know, Chapman is here to provide those comprehensive programs and services. And there are two main components that we really focus on, not only just providing the basic needs and support of those individuals, like feeding them and sheltering them every single day, but we focus on housing support and looking for housing and providing housing placements, but also employment. Employment is a key component in ensuring that someone stays out of homelessness. And so those dollars are there to support job training and job readiness for our residents at Chapman Partnership. And one of the key things that we're doing with those dollars is that we are using those to help support individuals that go through what we call our Social Enterprise Academy. Now that is a fancy way of saying that we have created a certificate-based program with the support of folks like Lennar Foundation, initially in construction, allowing our residents to take a 14-week training program to upskill them in the area of a construction. So once they graduate, they can walk away with five national certifications.
I want to kind of break this down to the bare essentials here. Let's say you get someone off the streets. All right. You got to house them for a certain amount of time while you're giving them the training, right?
Absolutely. So at Chapman Partnership, we do our residents physically stay on our campus. We have two centers that are stretched across Miami-Dade County, one in North Miami, and we have another location in the Homestead area. We have a 800-bed facility or facilities combined between the two locations. So the basic needs, and again, the housing support when they come on campus, they're there. It's roughly about 80 plus days that we have our residents on campus. There's not a specific time frame in which you need to leave. Our goal is to help you get back on your feet. But the average length of stay is generally around 80 days.
And so you're helping them to, you get the training or at least helping them get a job. What's the help? What's the support like helping them find housing?
Well, we also have a dedicated, and this is really where we've been very fortunate with the support of the Homeless Trust. We have certainly dedicated funds that are earmarked for housing support. We also have in-house a dedicated team of individuals that work with our clients to ensure they have all the documentation, paperwork to get into a house or home or an apartment. We also work with landlords in the community to find those units that are quote unquote affordable for our residents to live in. And so we attack it both ways. We make sure that the resident is prepared to take on this new journey in their life. And we also work in the community with landlords to ensure we have adequate inventory to be able to place our residents into those homes.
And as you said, on average, about 80 days to get
about 80 days. That's right. To go through this, technically to go through our program and get them housed.
Do you have a success rate? Is there a number we can look at and say this is how many or this is what rate of success we've had in this?
Absolutely. Our outplacement right now is roughly about 90%.
I mentioned functional zero.
Yes.
I keep hearing that. What does that mean?
Well, you know, by definition, it is, really is a measurable end to homelessness and being able to sustain that with the right systems in place. Certainly that is a target and a goal. That's something that many have been working toward for quite some time. It's always been the fight, of course, for those that I named at the beginning of the program. And to really be able to see Mayor Suarez take this rallying cry on and to really open up this level of awareness across our community is absolutely tremendous.
And
there have been so many people that have been fighting this battle for so long, but it's nice to really have more coming into the fold to really create the level of awareness, I think, that we all need to really get at this challenge that we have ahead of us.
Considering how long we as a society have been dealing with this issue, not just here in Miami, realistically, Samaria, do you think we can solve this problem? Is it possible?
Well, I will tell you, it is. I mean, you think about Miami as a whole, and you know, we've been very, very fortunate, quite honestly, even though we have some challenges that we see currently still on the streets of Miami, we've been very fortunate. I think we do have an opportunity to get there in Miami. I really do. Some of the other municipalities, some of the larger ones, such as Los Angeles, where they're looking at 70,000 on the streets, New York, et cetera, some of the ones that have significant challenges and issues, it may take a bit more. But I do think with having the right systems in place, a coordinated process like we have in Miami-Dade with the Homeless Trust and all the other organizations laddering up through that, I think that does make a difference
and
in the community.
I want to come back just briefly. You're a provider, and I wanted to help us understand that role in the community and how it's different from an advocacy group.
Absolutely. As a provider, we are front and center. Our goal, our mission, and our charge and our passion every day is to serve those folks who are facing homelessness. And I think you need all pieces working together, but we're on the front lines every day servicing them with the basic needs, whether it's the shelter, the food, making sure that they have adequate medical support when they come on campus. Also a clear roadmap of goals that our residents work on with our case managers, the housing, the employment, even the follow-up. So we provide those comprehensive services. So I do think you need all of them in order for this system to work, but we're right there on the front lines with so many that are making this happen.
There is a lot to talk about with this issue, and we're going to be tackling it throughout these upcoming months, and so I'm going to have you back, definitely. Samaria Hudson is the president and CEO of Chapman Partnership. Samaria, thank you so much for joining me today. We'll, again, have you back soon. We have a lot to talk about.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much. Thank you.
And again, we're talking about homelessness in Miami. The city commission, again, recently agreed to infuse $3.1 million in federal funding to try to get to this idea of functional zero homelessness in the city. You can send us your thoughts, your comments on this topic. Join our text club at 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. 877-677-0767. And share, by the way, what you're seeing. What do you see out there? I've noticed it. At least in some of the places I drive, I've noticed more. But I'd like to hear your thoughts. Joining me now is David Peary. He is the chair of the Consumer Advisory Board of the Camillus Health Concern Community Clinic. It serves the homeless population here in Miami. He's also the executive director of the Miami Coalition to Advance Racial Equity, or MCARE. David, great to have you back.
Hello, Lewis. Thank you very much.
You know, when Mayor Francis Suarez brought up this functional zero idea, I know you were following this press conference closely. What's your take from that?
Well, thank you, Lewis. Quite frankly, I'm not aware of what functional zero actually is. It appears to be something different than zero. And so there's somewhat of a misnomer in what it means. I would take that it is a well-intentioned, good faith effort to end homelessness. But quite frankly, it's not at all clear as to exactly what it is. And the definition tends to vary depending on whom you talk to.
Do you think it's a political move then?
Again, I simply do not understand where the actual definition comes from. All politicians, to an extent, do political things, quote unquote. But I do take it as a good faith effort to address a very serious issue that we have within our city.
You have experienced homelessness in Miami, and looking at, you know, the way this city has handled this issue in the past, what do you think about its goals moving forward? Do you think it can, functional zero or not, do you think it can deal with this problem?
Oh, well, most definitely. And here's where I'm in 100% agreement with Ms. Hudson. We know how to end homelessness. We know as a nation, we have done various amounts of research on it. We know that fundamentally to end homelessness is with homes, is with affordable housing, is with raising wages to create a livable wage. We actually have the money available to us in these ARPA funds that Mayor Francis Suarez allocated to various homelessness providers are part of the funds that we have available to us right here and now in which we can end homelessness. What we're lacking right now, Lewis, is really the political will to take all of the steps necessary to end homelessness. And in fact, we are taking certain actions right now to make homelessness worse in a far more expensive way, a far more expensive manner. And so in order for us to truly end homelessness in Miami, we must first stop the criminalization of homelessness.
And you're
talking, this is what Miami has been doing over this past years.
You're talking about, for example, recently the city was talking about, you know, making it illegal to camp out in the streets or, you know, to sleep out in the streets. And also there was the issue of, well, let's just have people adopt homeless to help them out. Those kind of things. That's what you're mostly focused on, right?
Yes, that last item that you mentioned, the Adopt a Homelessness program, was not a very serious effort. It was not serious at all. It was a very sarcastic effort by one of the Miami City commissioners to stick a thumb in the eye of the homeless advocates, so to speak. In fact, in an interview, he was not willing to adopt a homeless person himself. So this is nothing serious, and we should not waste any breath on that.
All right, let me move over to the other two, though. The ban on encampments and the restrictions on how groups can feed people experiencing homelessness. What are you seeing and hearing from the people that you help?
We're seeing and hearing an incredible amount of stress, anxiety, and compounding of the trauma on the streets. Homelessness itself is intensely traumatizing. And as you noted, I do have a lived experience of homelessness myself. You are vulnerable to theft. You're vulnerable to violence. You're vulnerable to the constant public stigmatization, judgmental condemnation of your fellow citizens. And no one freely chooses to be homeless. And through these efforts, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, the Miami City Commission passed an ordinance called the Large Group Feeding Ordinance that greatly restricted the way in which charities can serve food to groups of the homeless. As a direct result of that ordinance, there is far less food on the streets. You have far more people experiencing stress, anxiety, expressing hunger, and then you have much more, I would say, behavioral health issues. You have much more instances of depression. And in fact, you see, and I don't think it's mere correlation. I do think that there's a direct connection here. You see a far more increased incidence of overdoses, of deaths on the streets as a result, not just of the pandemic, but also as a result, I believe, of Miami's efforts to both restrict food and also in other areas to criminalize homelessness.
So let me ask again your take then on what the city is trying to do, putting this money out there. Again, for more beds for shelters, mental health treatment and job training, are we on the right track?
Well, that part of it is part of the track, quote unquote, but that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. What the monies that we're talking about right now are federal ARPA monies that was passed, I believe, sometime last year. And so our mayor allocated those monies to various homeless shelter providers and various programs. And that's all well and good. And it's very necessary and it's very needed. Unfortunately, what we're not seeing is money. And I believe Ms. Hudson mentioned this, is money that's actually going into increasing the inventory of permanent housing, of affordable housing, and of supportive housing. This is the ultimate end to homelessness. Once we actually increase the inventory of housing in which we can use our vouchers, for instance, the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, I believe, has certain housing vouchers that they can give away, and other homeless providers have housing vouchers that they can give to the person who are eligible for them. But they often are faced with a brick wall of finding the actual units inventory in order to use these vouchers. And so we must, first of all, increase the inventory of permanent and affordable housing. And that will ultimately lead to ending homelessness. And that's where we're not seeing the money directed towards.
Yeah, right. And I know you keep mentioning ARPA. I just want to remind people that's the American Rescue Plan. I asked Ms. Hudson about this. I wanted your thoughts on this because, again, I'm seeing more encampments. And let me finish with this. But, you know, she said those tend to be the folks who they've been homeless the longest.
Yes.
How do you help those folks?
Okay. The encampments that you referred to, the tents that popped up on Southwest First Avenue between Miami and the Miami Avenue and the Miami River,
yep.
Many of those individuals were actually relocated or dislocated as a result of a dismantling and an eviction of an encampment on the neighboring Southwest Second Street.
I see.
So they were actually moved about a block up, but many of them are new to that area. We've actually gone down there several times within the last week or so, and we agree with you that homelessness is expanding, that the homelessness issue is getting worse.
You know, and David, the last time I had you on, we talked about that you were concerned that with, you know, the issue of the pandemic and people being evicted, that it was going to get worse. Have you seen that from the pandemic?
What? Exactly as to the causal connection between the pandemic, between the end of the eviction moratorium, and simply as a result of the just general affordable housing crisis that we're in right now, I think it's a function of all of those factors. I don't think that you can assign it primarily to any one of those factors. But we are seeing within this last year or so, an expansion of the people who are on the streets, or as you say, or as Ms. Hudson referenced, the chronically homeless.
Yeah.
And these are the most visible faces of homelessness. And these are the individuals that we would want to provide the path out of homelessness for through affordable housing. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that the city of Miami is spending money to make the problem worse. Or actually, by passing efforts to restrict food on the streets, by passing laws to arrest the homeless and restrict them from sleeping on public property, they're actually making the problem worse because it doesn't solve the root issue, which is lack of affordable housing. Right. What it does is compound the trauma of the people on the streets and makes it harder for them to escape the cycle of homelessness.
We still have that invitation out to numerous city officials to come on and talk about this issue. But David Peary, I always appreciate when you do. Again, he's the chair of the Consumer Advisory Board of the Camillus Health Concern Community Clinic. David, always appreciate your insight on this issue. We'll continue this conversation throughout the months to come.
Well, thank you very much, Lewis. It's a pleasure to be here.
And again, we want to hear from you, your thoughts on this topic. You can always text us 786-677-0767 or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let's change things up. Still to come, we're going to take a trip back to a piece of Miami Beach's history before it's gone. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. A little bit of the Beatles behind us there. You know, Miami Beach is about to lose one of its historic sites, the Deauville Beach Resort. It's the place where America fell in love with the Beatles.
Ladies and gentlemen, here are four of the nicest youngsters we've ever had on our stage. The Beatles, bring them on.
And of course, that's them live on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was broadcast from one of the hotel's ballrooms. You know, that resort has also hosted President John F. Kennedy, Frank Sinatra, and Samuel George Davis Jr. It's in danger of being demolished. This after a report found structural damage. Joining me now is Bob Keeling. He's an author publishing a book about the Beatles' time in Florida. He's been outspoken about preserving the Deauville. Bob, great to have you. Thanks for joining. All right. My apologies. We had a little technical issue here. No worries. We're going to get him on there. Bob, you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, there you are, Bob. How's it going?
Oh, very well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, great to have you. Always love talking a little bit of history. You know, besides the Beatles, really, their arrival, that was really what kind of made the hotel, right? But there have been a lot of famous people going through this place.
Oh, sure. I mean, just fairly recently in the hotel's history, Arturo Sandoval had his own club there. And then as you go back further in time, you had John F. Kennedy speaking on the stage that is still there in the historic Napoleon Ballroom, speaking at the height of Camelot. Ronald Reagan stayed there. A number of African-American artists like Sammy Davis Jr., Diana Ross, and the Supremes, when North Beach was still segregated. And African-Americans couldn't go to these concerts that African-American artists were putting on. So, yeah, there's a great deal of history besides the Beatles.
Take me back to Miami, though, when the Beatles arrived for the first time. What was it like and you know, what that arrival meant for the city?
What I like to say is when the Beatles first appeared on Sullivan from the Ed Sullivan Theater, that's when America fell in love with them. But when they came to Miami Beach later that week, that's where they fell in love with America. And these are kids from Workaday Liverpool who had never seen palm trees, had never experienced these beaches. And they were supposed to leave that Monday after the Sullivan show. And they're like, no, let's stay the rest of the week. And sure enough, they did. They ended up being there 8.5 days. So I would say that this is one of the top two or three Beatle landmarks in America. And to think that we're at this precipice where this whole historic campus may be torn down is just a tragedy.
Yeah, you're part of an initiative calling for the rescue, for the renovation of the 60th anniversary of that moment with the Beatles. So it's February of 64. What's the initiative? What are you trying to do?
It's called the Deauville 21624 Initiative. And if you want to read more about it, you can go on SaveTheDeauville.com website. And on there, you'll see a message from Mitzi Gaynor, who starred with the Beatles that night from the Deauville on Ed Sullivan in front of 70 million people. she's coming out in support of our efforts to save this historic structure. And, you know, she just says she applauds the efforts of organizations like the Miami Design Preservation League for bringing attention to the need to preserve the hotel. So this is an urgent issue. And our message is, this is not over. We are we're pursuing several avenues to see what we can do to at least get part of the historic heart of the Deauville campus saved. Yeah.
And again, Mitzi Gaynor, as you mentioned, singer headlining for the Beatles at the Ed Sullivan Show. She wrote this recently on her Facebook page, actually yesterday, quote, "The gorgeous Deauville Hotel in Miami Beach is a cherished part of my life and a landmark in showbiz history. The Deauville helped establish Miami Beach as the sun and fun capital of the world, and its showroom welcomed me and a host of artists in an era when this magic city was second only to Las Vegas as a major entertainment destination. My wish is that this great lady of show business will somehow be saved and restored to its former glory. I hope the good people of the city of Miami Beach and its officials will help," end quote. Do you think, though, the city of Miami Beach is ready to save the Deauville?
We don't know, but we certainly are. And we are not giving up, and this is not over. And what the city has to do some way is to get a second independent structural assessment report of what is going on inside that hotel, inside that campus. Somebody to give an independent eye, perhaps towards renovation, not just demolition. Nobody wants another tragedy, not at all. But we would argue that at the very least, the historic heart of the building, the Napoleon Ballroom, of course, that beautiful entryway, that can be saved. The stage that's still there to this day can be saved. And, you know, if anybody is interested in that effort, we have a spot fund, Save the Deauville effort going as well. So there are many ways you can get involved if you feel the way we do.
And do you, but Bob, do you, or would you be satisfied with just saving part of it?
Yes. The historic heart, we absolutely would. It's not like we're not trying to come to some sort of agreement to render this campus safe. We know that there has been some, it's run down. Frankly, it's been allowed to rot over the last 5 years. But be that as it may, you know, long term, the city has to figure out a way to close these loopholes where owners can just go to court and keep it in litigation forever and circumvent the efforts to avoid this demolition via neglect. So this isn't over. We're exploring several avenues, and we think the Deauville is worth fighting for, and we hope others do too.
Again, I'm talking with Bob Keeling. He's an author publishing a book about the Beatles' time in Florida, talking about the historic Deauville Hotel, Miami Beach. It was shut down after an electric fire in 2017. It's been deteriorating since. A building official he had mentioned had issued a demolition order earlier this month after an inspection found structural damage to the building. Bob is part of a group pushing to rescue and preserve the hotel for the 60th anniversary of when the Beatles stayed here. This again back in February of 1964. By the way, we've also heard from other folks like Amy Garcia Phillips from New Jersey. She participated in salsa dancing competitions at the Deauville. Let's take a listen.
When I was a dancer years ago at Paul Pellicoro's Dance Sport, we would take yearly competitions down to Miami for the International Hustle and Salsa competition with Billy Fajardo. I remember for many years the competition was at the Deauville. And my first year going down, just being amazed by the grandeur of the hotel. And then, you know, years as the years go by, just being so excited to go down there. There was always something going on. There were competitions in the ballrooms during the days. There were dance parties all night. It was such an incredible, such an incredible place. And then also, one year I was engaged and getting married, and my friends came down and we made a bigger weekend of it. So they came down a few days before the competition and we had my bachelorette party and, you know, out to dinner and things, but it was all around the Deauville. And I heard that they're taking it down or thinking about taking it down. And that makes me so sad. It was such, I have such fond memories there. And that place holds a very special spot in my heart.
And a lot of people seem to have some history with that. You know, Bob, I wanted to come back because I mentioned you're working on a book about when the Beatles were there. And you got to talk to a lot of people who were there when the Beatles were there, who actually had encounters with the Beatles. You got some really cool stories.
Thanks. And probably the best one is their security guard was Sergeant Buddy Dresner of the Miami Beach Police Department. And he was this Forrest Gump type figure that I counted that within 99 days, he guarded JFK, guarded the Beatles and Cassius Clay while never leaving home. You know, this was such a watershed time. And that's why this particular campus is so important to the wonderful cultural melting pot that is Miami Beach. And to see it lost and just, you know, strafing it all away and not even taking any concern to try to save the historic heart would just be an absolute tragedy.
Tell me some more about Buddy. Who, Buddy, this guy sounds fascinating.
Oh, Buddy's great. He, his son, Barry, was kind enough to give me access to this long interview with his dad who passed away in 2004. And he's just this Mac the Knife kind of all business guy, but he had a good sense of humor. And he even connected with John Lennon, who challenged him about why the U.S. was butting in Vietnam already. And he really developed deep connections with these guys. And I remember one great story where he's out on a cruise with them and he's like, now look, fellas, you know, taking the fatherly approach. They're all still in their early 20s. And Buddy's like, now your fame's not going to last. So you need to save your money. You need to get yourself a good lawyer. Okay, fellas? And they're like, yeah, bud, sure, sounds good. And that's just another part of this wonderful story. The Beatles relationship with the Deauville, where they were there. They were in Florida for a longer period than any other time in the United States in this watershed year, 1964.
If you had never seen a palm tree, you wouldn't want to leave either. You know, one of the things I was thinking about is really fascinating is, you know, here I am. I've spent almost 8 years now in Miami, and I was in Las Vegas before this. And what the two cities share, I think, in common is they don't hold on to their history very well because the real estate is really valuable. And why keep that history when I could build a very nice swanky hotel and retail and make a lot more money? I mean, do you think that's the issue here? We're not good at protecting that history. We're not going to do it.
Well, think about how damaged that area would be had they let those gorgeous Art Deco hotels just get mowed down. Back in the day in the 80s. Thank God they saved that. And I would appeal directly to the owners of this campus, and they know who they are. If at least let's save the historic heart of the Deauville, the historic arch entryway, the Napoleon Ballroom, where the stage the Beatles performed on and JFK spoke, is still there. We would argue that low-slung two-story part of the whole campus does not present an imminent threat to health and safety. No one wants that, but we just need to be a little bit more careful and better stewards about what we're doing with our history, because once we mow it down, as we all know, it's all gone.
And I agree with you. I will say this, it's sadly, you know, in Vegas, all of that old stuff is gone, except in one place. There's a place called the Neon Graveyard where they've tried to save as many of the old signs as possible. I don't even see that effort here in South Florida to save some of the old stuff somewhere, but I'm hoping some of this is protected.
I hope so too, because having done the research, I feel a much stronger attachment to what the Beatles did there. They wrote multiple songs for the Hard Day's Night film. John Lennon took delivery on a brand new guitar while they were staying at the Deauville. This wasn't just a fleeting moment in time.
Yeah.
And there are other cities where all the Beatles did was come and perform at a particular building. Those buildings have been saved, like Washington, D.C. is a perfect example. And the fact that we would let this place be torn down to rubble, unfortunately, just perpetuates the stereotype that Florida doesn't give a damn, and you know, let's put up a strip mall and move on, or you know, let's go for the brass ring in terms of how much money we can get for a particular piece of property. Let's be a little bit better stewards of this very unique landmark, and let's at least save the historic heart of it.
Bob Keeling, I really appreciate the time. Looking forward to that book. Any story about the Beatles, always fun. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for your time.
And by the way, you can find more about this story of the Deauville on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Monday, January 24th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with Friends of the Everglades about the current federal efforts and the efforts in Tallahassee on deck to restore the Everglades. All of that tomorrow on the show. Don't forget, if you missed any of the program, you can catch a replay tonight at 8 or find us on your podcast app. Just look up WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Yeah, yeah. With a love like that, you know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad. You know you should be.